So this is work that we've done with Yimin Chen and Ed Witten. And the outline of this talk is that we will consider black holes in weakly coupled string theory. When the black hole size is close to the string scale, they are supposed to turn into highly excited strings. And we'll discuss some aspects of this transition. Surprisingly, the situation seems to be different in the heterotic and the type 2 string cases. And we'll discuss also the implications of this for some charged black holes. So the assumptions throughout this talk, we will be considering a weakly coupled string theory where the string coupling is much, much smaller than one. We'll set L string to one, alpha prime to one, and then the Newton constant will be proportional to G squared and will be very small. And we will consider the type 2 or the heterotic superstring. And we will work mostly in four dimensions. So what I mean here is that there will be four non-compact dimensions and six compact dimensions that will not play much of a role in this discussion. So if we consider a highly excited string, so as the string gets more and more highly excited, its size starts growing and its mass grows. And its entropy in that highly excited regime for a free string, it is linear in the mass with some coefficient that by definition we call the Hagedorn inverse temperature. And the thermal ensemble of such free strings is well defined only when beta is bigger than this beta h, because the partition function will be an integral over the mass of this entropy factor. The actual entropy has some prefactors that are some powers of m, but here in the exponent, this will converge only when beta is bigger than beta h. Okay. So beta h is a kind of limiting temperature for free strings. Now, on the other hand, we have black holes. Black holes are well defined when the Schwarzschild radius is much bigger than one, so much bigger than the string scale. And the leading alpha prime corrections were computed in various cases a long time ago. And one can ask what happens when these black holes approach the string size. And what we are asking here is about the string generalization of the Schwarzschild solution. So general relativity is a theory of gravity and its simplest spherically symmetric solution is a Schwarzschild solution. And so you can ask, what is this simplest spherically symmetric solution of classical string field theory? So that's what we'll be talking about. And interestingly, we don't know the exact solution. So we'll be talking about various approximations because we don't yet know the exact solution. Now, one observation that was made a long time ago by these authors here is that if you plot the entropy as a function of the mass, then for a free string, as we just saw, it's a linear function. And for a black hole, it's a, let's say in four dimensions, it's a quadratic function. So the entropy goes like the square of the radius and the mass goes like the radius. So it's quadratic in the mass. And then the two lines cross at a mass of order one over g string square. And at that point, the size of the black hole is of order one. And it was proposed that perhaps what happens at this size is that the black hole becomes a highly excited string. This is also in agreement with the idea that the Hawking temperature of such a black hole would be of order string scale, of order this Hagedorn temperature, so it will emit lots of strings and perhaps become some free string. So that's the idea. Now, this idea was, of course, qualitative because we cannot trust those solutions at this point. So the black hole solution, we can only trust for a very large radius and also a free string far away from this point. And so that's an extrapolation of these two plots, okay? So the question we would like to ask is whether there is a smooth transition between black holes and a highly excited string. And you could ask, well, why do we care about this? Well, one motivation is that in the string picture, the microstates are very explicit. And so we know what the microstates of the configuration are. These are the various states of the string, but there is no interior. On the other hand, for black holes, there is some interior, but there are no obvious microstates. And so if you could go continuously between these two pictures, you might learn how these two features match smoothly to each other. So that is the motivation. We will not say anything more about this, in fact, because we do not know. Well, we'll say something on whether this is a smooth transition or not, but this was some more general motivation. And also, we'll also like to understand how string theory changes black hole thermodynamics. So when you have strings and so that's a general, also general questions for about string scale black holes. So in fact, you can make the same plot, including the first corrections. So somehow the corrections, modifications of the thermodynamics from the black hole side, it pulls it a bit into the left side here. Also you can consider the first corrections from the string theory side. And these first corrections will include including the self-gravity of the string, and I will describe that solution in a moment. So before we go into that, let's make some comments, general comments about strings at finite temperature. There is an interesting way to think about string theory at finite temperature, which is to compactify the Euclidean time direction. Of course, that's a standard way of thinking about anything at finite temperature. But the interesting feature of strings is that there is the possibility of having a string that winds around that compact circle. So that's special to string theory. And then you can think about in the lower dimensional theory about this mode, this particular mode of the string is might become light when you approach the this Hagedorn temperature. So the mass square of this mode goes like beta squared minus beta h squared. And precisely at beta h, it becomes cyclonic. That, in fact, that's how this beta h is defined. So that's the same beta h that we discussed previously. And so if we are very close to this value, then this field will be light and can be included in the low energy theory. So in particular, you can include, well, both this light field as well as the massless fields in the lower dimensions, in the spatial dimensions. And this includes gravity, for example, and also, of course, the dilaton and so on. And the most important interactions will be the ones that involve, let's say, gravity. And it will be attractive and will end up being something like a chi to the fourth term. So there are also some direct self-interactions of the scalar, but they are less important than the interactions that are induced by integrating out these massless fields. That's because these fields are very light. Well, are massless. Please ask a question.
The one string, I guess, couples to the B field. Do you need to keep?
Yes.
Do you need to keep that into the low energy effective action, or that's subleading in some sense?
Yeah, that's subleading because this winding mode will wind in both directions. So, well, it's it will get an expectation value, right? Mm-hmm. It's a complex field, and so we will not have some net. In other words, there will not be a net winding charge. So, and for that reason, there is no large coupling to the B field, at least certainly in this setup. There are other setups where there might be a background B field, and that might be a little more complicated, like, for example, strings in ADS3 at finite temperature and so on. So, now this leads to, so considering solutions of this low energy action leads to an interesting solution, which was found a long time ago by Horowitz and Polchinski. And it describes a self-gravitating string. So it's a solution that is localized in three spatial dimensions. So we have, so this is roughly a plot of the solution. So it's spherically symmetric, and the winding mode is maximum at the center and it decreases when you go far away. And it describes essentially a self-gravitating string in thermal equilibrium. And it has the peculiar feature that its size decreases as the mass increases. So in fact, the size goes like 1/g² m, and also m, the mass goes like beta minus beta h. So the solution becomes more massive as we go away from beta minus beta h. Now, this size should be larger than one in order to trust the gravitational approximation. And it unfortunately, this means that g squared m has to be smaller than one, and the correspondence point, or the point where these two were supposed to be, where the string and the black hole are supposed to match, was when G square M is of order one, and also when the size is of order one. So so we cannot trust the solution near that correspondence point, but we can trust it further away. Now, one interesting aspect of the solution is that it has a classical entropy in string theory. So you can calculate the entropy using the usual formula. So there is some action, and you can calculate 1 minus beta d beta of this problem. And normally, if we were dealing with an ordinary gravity solution, this would give us 0, because the time circle in this solution is never contracts to 0. So it's not a black hole. But in this case, the mass of the string has some explicit beta dependence. And for that reason, we actually get some non-zero entropy. And so we get a non-zero entropy, which is proportional to chi squared. Okay. And when you calculate what this entropy is, it turns out that the entropy, you can also separately compute the mass, and it turns out that it is linear in the mass. And there is some extra correction that you can calculate. So it's the same as, in terms of the mass and entropy, it's the same as the free string. Maybe I'll just skip that. So there is one side comment here. This is a solution that represents, it's describing a localized tachyon condensate. So it's localized in the sense that, maybe I should have said that before. Let me go back. So the main mode of gravity that is excited by the solution will be basically the size of this extra dimension, of the compact dimension. That's because the mass is very small, and so all other gravity modes will couple just to the mass. But when you vary just the size, you couple only to this term, so you don't have the cancellation between these two terms. Okay, so for that reason, that's the dominant mode. And the size becomes smaller near the center of the solution, and at infinity such that the mass square is bigger than one, but bigger than zero, sorry. But then when you get near the center, it's actually less than zero. And so that enables you to have this localized tachyon condensate. And if you view the Euclidean time as a special circle, then this HP solution can be viewed as a bubble decay solution. So it's nucleating the decay that will be due to the condensation of this tachyon. And it's conceptually related to Witten's bubble of nothing decay of flat space that involves also a black hole. So it's basically the same thing. So that was just a side comment. Now here I have a little plot of the size of the configuration. So for the black hole, as you take M larger, its size becomes larger. And it's a further string scale when mass is equal to 1 over g squared. This is a regime we cannot really describe. So this is an extrapolation. Then this HP solution has a size which increases as you decrease the mass. And then at some point, this HP solution as a classical solution breaks down. So you start having large quantum fluctuations around the solution. And that's the regime where qualitatively would match with a free string solution, just a very highly excited string. So this had a size which was increasing with the mass. So the size as a function of the mass does something funny like this. The string is getting larger, and then the self-gravity starts making smaller, and then you have the black hole starts getting larger again. This is the geometry of the Euclidean black hole. I guess you are probably all very familiar with it, so I won't dwell on it. One point that I want to emphasize is that whenever you have a black hole, you also have some kind of winding condensate for the winding modes. And that's because if you have a string that winds, you are considering, for example, the web of a winding mode, there will be a contribution to this vacuum expectation value from a string wall sheet that wraps the Euclidean cigar, so the Euclidean time and the radial direction of the black hole. And that gives rise to a small expectation value for the winding condensate. So the winding symmetry is always broken. The phase of this chi is related to the integral of a B field over the cigar. And in principle, in the full theory, we should integrate over it, and that restores the symmetry. but that's something you see at one loop. So at the classical limit, you really have the symmetry is broken. Now, the interpretation of this winding condenser is that it's related to a thermal atmosphere of strings. You can think of this as a string that comes out of the horizon, and it's highly excited. And it's a classical contribution to the entropy, so formally of order 1 over g squared, but not calculable, at least to my knowledge, since it's concentrated near the horizon. Some of those have conjecture or claim to prove that this is all the entropy, but I don't think there is a really convincing argument. Notice that the winding symmetry is spontaneously broken both in the black hole phase and in the highly excited string phase. The black hole phase we just mentioned, and the highly excited string phase, we explicitly had chi, which was non-zero. And this is consistent with the suggestion that they could be, these two solutions could be continuously connected without any phase transition. The black hole solution is good for beta much bigger than LS or beta H, and the HB solution is good when they are very close. So if beta is the horizontal line, at beta H, so near beta H, we have this HB solution under control. In the green, we have when the black hole solution is under control, and we are trying to understand what this interpolating solution is, or whether there it exists. What should be this interpolating solution? So this interpolating solution is supposed to be a classical solution of string theory, and what that means is that it should be some two-dimensional Wahlschmidt conformal field theory, and it's a CFT with central charge 4, or C hat equal to 4, and supposed to describe one part of the geometry. And then there is a conformal field theory with C hat equal to 6, which is supposed to describe the internal dimensions. And so we're going to look for a factorized solution like this, and this CFT C hat equal to 4 should have one parameter, which is beta, and then we should be able to interpolate in this parameter and go from one configuration to the other. So the first point is that in the type 2 string case, actually this is not possible. So this was somewhat surprising to us. Well, it was surprising to me at least. So this is argued as follows. So consider a CFT. So we're going to consider a CFT quantity that is invariant under deformation and under discontinuous deformations. So this will be the Witten index of the 1,1 supersymmetric Wahlschmidt CFT. So notice that the Wahlschmidt CFT is supersymmetric, even though the target space is not supersymmetric. Okay, so that's just standard in string theory. And so we consider the Witten index, which is trace of minus 1 to the f times e to the minus beta h. So this beta tilde has nothing to do with the spacetime beta. This is some Wahlschmidt conformal. This is some Wahlschmidt temperature, and h is the Wahlschmidt Hamiltonian. And so this quantity is invariant under deformations. And on the HP side, we find that, this Witten index for a sigma model, so if the sigma model has a geometric description, is actually equal to the Euler characteristic. So the on the HP side, because the geometry is essentially that of flat space, this is zero. And on the black hole side, the Euler characteristic is 2. And so, so they are different. And so there cannot be a continuous connection between these two. So there should be something that goes on perhaps at some point here. There might be that there is a first order transition and you can continue each of the two independently and something breaks down in each of them separately. Or perhaps the simplest perhaps hypothesis is that something happens here. There is some maybe higher order phase transition between the two sides. But we don't really know what happens. So then we can also consider the heterotic theory. In the heterotic theory, now we have a Wahlschmidt 1,0 CFT, so it's somewhat similar. And the index can also be computed in this case, and it's actually equal to 0 on both sides. other known invariants are also the same. And there is actually a linear sigma model analysis, which suggests that they are continuously connected. I will describe that analysis in a second. Well, maybe before I get into this, are there any questions? Okay, so I'll describe this linear sigma model analysis. So the idea here is that we will try to construct the Wahlschmidt CFT as the infrared limit of a simpler problem. So we start with a simpler problem which involves free fields and then a potential. So, or because we are dealing with a supersymmetric theory, we'll add some kind of superpotential. And so the idea is that in the infrared, it will flow. Right, this.
Yeah. I do have a question. I was just trying to think how to phrase it. So if we don't know the sigma, can you give a little bit more details? How did we do this computation of the index 0 and 2?
Yes. So we know, so the idea is that the index doesn't depend on the parameters, right? So we can go to extreme values of the parameters. So in order to calculate it, for example, in this case, in order to calculate it, well, this in both cases on the black, well, in this case, we can go to on the black hole side to very large values where we have a very big black hole, very, very large values of the size. So where we have a very big black hole. And there, what we have is essentially a sigma model, right? The CFT is just a standard sigma model on a non-trivial target space, which is the black hole target space. And then for such models, the index for 1.1 supersymmetric theories with that target space is the Euler characteristic. Now, perhaps I should explain a little more where this comes from. So the index receives contributions only from the ground states. So what we're considering is the number of Ramon ground states and counted with a -1 to the F, okay? And what that amounts to is considering all the various fluxes that you can, I mean, the Ramon ground states are related to somehow to the various fluxes that you can have. In other words, or wave functions for strings, which are infinitesimal perturbations of those fluxes. Over the Ramon, you know, the various anti-symmetric, the tensors with anti-symmetric indices, field strings with anti-symmetric indices. Those are related to these differential forms in the target space. And so if you count them with, so let's say the zero forms count like one, count the number of zero forms minus the number of one forms plus the number of two forms and so on. That gives you the so-called Euler characteristic, and that's equal to this index.
So this HP solution, I don't have any intuition for it. It's not like a black hole. Topologically, it's different.
Yeah, it's not like a black hole. And for these purposes, what's important is that the target space has the topology of S1 times R3. And you can go to very large sizes where the Tychon condensate is very small, right? Mm-hmm. And in that regime is essentially that of S1 times R3. Now there is a subtlety with this discussion, which is that the space is non-compact, so you have to be a little careful about this case. But far away, you always have the same topology and the same geometry, essentially in both cases. So you could add a very tiny potential, for example, to the sigma model that removes the those directions far away.
So a naive question. So you say that under small deformations, these are invariant. But if I add a very tiny wormhole to one of these...
Yeah, this was badly expressed. It's invariant under continuous deformations. So what's important, yeah.
But what about adding a tiny wormhole? How do I know that there is no tiny wormhole?
It would not be invariant under changing the topology of the space and so on. But that's supposed to be a large... That's not a deformation that is continuously connected. So the target space of the Wahlschmidt CFT is, let me say it more clearly. So we're imagining we have a family of CFTs, which are always well-defined and where you know, mm-hmm. all it always has an identity operator and it's well separated from the rest of the states. And, so that whenever we do a deformation, we let's say we do it with conformal perturbation theory, and it's always well defined. We never, so the way an index could cease to be continuous is if there is a new branch that opens up and the target space changes in a drastic way asymptotically.
Yeah, I guess my confusion is, of course, I cannot transform an orange into a donut, but if I look closely at the orange and there is a small wormhole, a small handle, then I could deform it, right? So could I start with this Horowitz-Polchinski plus a very tiny handle that I cannot see almost, and then grow that handle? And
that thing with the tiny handle is not the conformal field theory we started from, right? So we started with a conformal field theory whose target space was S1 times S3 in that limit. So there is manifestly no handle.
Okay.
I mean, we're doing just classical string theory, nothing fancy. It's very simple.
Good. Okay,
so,
thanks.
Is that clear?
Sure.
Yeah. Rob, did you have a question?
I was just wondering, since you got interrupted, you've been focusing on four dimensions, and I'm just wondering, is that a convenience, or would similar results apply for black holes in any number of dimensions?
It's a convenience, and the story is simpler as I'm describing it in only four dimensions. In five and six dimensions, there are some solutions that are somewhat similar to this Horowitz-Polchinski solution. They have some further sort of instabilities and so on. There are a few more things I would have to say. And then for higher dimensions, there aren't solutions like this. So four dimensions would be the case where it would be simplest to look for this transition. Now, okay. I should say, well, you might say, well, why do we care about something if it only happens in 4D, right? Well, you could certainly say that. But I guess what we are trying to do here is we are trying to find this transition in a context where we are in thermal equilibrium, right? So, now, normally when you want to be in thermal equilibrium, that because of the condition that you want to be in thermal equilibrium is that you have these restrictions, roughly. I mean, that this free string in higher dimensions does not self-gravitate enough to be in nice thermal equilibrium. I mean, you can have it in thermal equilibrium, but it will be very big, very different from the black hole. So in order to find this transition in the context of thermal equilibrium, it would be simplest in 4D. Now, presumably, the transition also happens in higher D dynamically. If you had an evaporating black hole, you would have this transition that would happen dynamically. It would be a more complicated dynamical process that would happen and would be harder to analyze. So we are focused on the simplest case where we can use sort of Euclidean methods to analyze it. Is that clear?
But it's really the HP side, HP solution.
Yes.
That becomes more complicated as I go to higher dimensions. Or
exactly. That's the point. Yes.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Sure. Okay. So now I'm going to describe this idea of the linear sigma models. So the idea is that you start from a theory of free bosons and free fermions with 1-0 supersymmetry. And then you add some kind of supersymmetric preserving term, which is an integral over the corresponding superspace of some function that I'll specify in a second of the superfields. And then there is some fermionic superfield that has to do with the left moving fermions, with an extra left moving fermion.
Once
you expand this in superfields, you go back to bosonic fields, you end up seeing that all that happens is that you are adding an extra potential for the bosonic fields that you had. So the bosonic fields are five fields. So we want to describe something whose target space is four-dimensional, but we start with five fields. So the X field are, we divide them into two sets. So first we have the X field of which there are two and the Y field of which there are three. And then we choose here some particular function that it's just a simple quartic potential, almost a fairly general quartic potential. And it's chosen in such a way that when we set it to zero, then we can solve, for example, for X, and we find that X has this expression. So let's say when Y is very large, then X has a constant size. So that can be viewed as the circle far away. And then Y can be anything. So that's three of the dimensions. So we have three of the dimensions parameterized by Y. And then the circle that is varying as you vary Y. So as Y becomes smaller, the circle becomes smaller. And then depending on the sign of this combination of constants, we either have a solution with the HP topology or a solution with the black hole topology. Okay, so if this is bigger than zero, what this means is that when Y is equal to zero, this size is still positive. So it's still, so we have something where this circle never shrinks. On the other hand, if this ever becomes negative, then we cannot take Y to that value. So Y should always be bigger than the value of Y that makes this zero, okay? That would be the black hole horizon. So this is the topology of the space on where W is equal to zero. And the idea is that as we vary the parameters, the classical vacuum manifold is similar to the HP or to the black hole topology. So for now, we are only focusing on the topology of the problem. So the idea is that in the UV, we start with free fields plus this potential, and then when we go to somewhat lower energies, we have this classical vacuum manifold given by W equal to zero. And then if we continue flowing to the infrared, then this space where W is equal to zero is not Ricci flat. So it will flow non-trivially. So it will change under the renormalization group and the metric will change. And we did not analyze this in detail, but the idea is that the metric will be adjusted so that we actually indeed have a CFD. Now in the UV theory, there were three parameters, constants A, B, and C. And in the infrared theory, we expected only one marginal parameter beta, okay? So we have to explain how we go from three parameters to one parameter. Now, the idea is that the infrared solution should also have another relevant parameter. And this is because both the HP solution and the black hole solution have one negative mode. So there is one off-shell negative mode. And that in the conformal field theory language means that there will be one operator with dimension less than one. And so that implies that in order to get the solution, we will have to fine tune some combination of A, B, and C. So we need to do one fine tuning to find the solution. And then we expect that the third parameter is probably irrelevant, but we did not check it explicitly. So classically, so at this point, classically all three are look marginal, but then as we flow to the infrared, some of them are expected to become relevant and some are expected to become irrelevant. So one is expected to become irrelevant, one relevant, and the other two, and the last one is supposed to be marginal, which should correspond to beta. Now in this particular model, nothing special happens when B minus C over A is equal to zero. So there is no new branch appearing there. So we expect that the flow to an infrared CFT should not show any surprise. Now in principle, it could be, of course, when you flow to the, when you are doing these RC flows, it might be that you start from some two theories which look very similar in the UV and they become drastically different in the infrared. But at least there is no obvious reason why they should become drastically different. So So in the intermediate stages, these intermediate energies, the two theories are continuously connected. And after we flow to the infrared, we expect that to be the case, but this is, as I just said, it's not a proof. It's just simply an indication for a continuous connection. Now, what is different in the type 2 case? So you can do a similar analysis in the type 2 situation. And so here, the difference is that we now have two integrals over theta. And so this super potential will need to be a function of the, will be a function which will be the same as the function we had before, but we'll have to introduce a new super field, which we call T, okay? So there are six variables. So the five we had before and this variable P we have now. And then the idea is that after we integrate everything out, after we integrate out theta, so after we integrate over theta, we get for the bosonic variables now this potential, okay? And now the conditions that this vanishes can be solved by setting W equal to zero and P equal to zero. And then we get this same manifold we had before. And the directions orthogonal to the surface and also P are massive around this vacuum, okay? And again, we have the two possible topologies. But now when B minus C over A is equal to zero, a new classical branch appears. So when P, where X and Y could be set to zero. So if this combination of constants is zero, then we can set X and Y equal to zero, and then we'll obey that W is equal to zero. But now we can have solutions with non-zero P, okay? Okay, so and that's we said that was one reason why the index would be different, and that's okay, some justification classically. The real story is a little more complicated, and I'm going to try to explain it now. Turns out that on this classical P branch, super potential is actually generated, and depending on the sign of this quantity, we either do or do not get new supersymmetric vacua in this massive supersymmetric vacua on this branch. So these isolated vacua are massive, and because there is a superpotential, so now there is no really new branch that is appearing, new massless branch. So now the index actually has the same value on both sides in the full UV theory. But what happens is that the UV theory flows in the infrared to a CFT plus this isolated massive vacuum. And so even though the index of the whole thing is continuous, in the infrared, you either flow to a CFT, only just the CFT, or the CFT plus some extra vacuum, depending on the sign of this quantity. But for constructing a string theory, we really care about the CFT. So for the infrared CFT, of course, the index has changed. So. Okay, so that's the index of the full UV theory is the same, but the index of the infrared part or the CFT part of the infrared theory is different due to the extra massive vacuum. And so maybe I'll make a comment here. This is what, yeah, that's it. So the fact that this happens has prevented us from making a reasonable conjecture of exactly what happens at this point where there was a cross. So there were other situations where you had similar transitions, for example, the conic fold transition, there was a conjecture that was made by Oguri and Baffa. And it has to do with the appearance of a new branch at that point. But here, since we don't really have a new branch, we cannot make a similar conjecture, for those who know who that conjecture is.
Can I ask a question? It's probably completely wrong, but I mean,
yeah, please.
There's some like topological field theory description of this massive vacuum, and if so, couldn't you then just kind of enrich the CFT with some topological field theory to account for that?
Well, it's not either you are in the massive vacua, right? or you have the CFT. It's not that you have the CFT plus the topological.
Okay, so there is a
relative. Yeah, I mean, I think your question, I think it's an interesting question whether these massive vacua play any role in the in the Wellsheet theory. One role we explored, but we didn't come to any conclusion, is that you could have domain walls that go perhaps between the CFT and this vacua,
mm-hmm.
and that these domain walls might be related to deep brains in the theory, but we couldn't make the case very clear, and it was highly sensitive to the UV parameters. Mm-hmm. It was sensitive to the exact setup. And there are some subtleties I'm not discussing here, and it depends on those subtleties. So it was, yeah, so that was an idea, for example, of how I think it didn't really work. So,
okay.
Can I hate to be annoying, but if I added a bunch of extra Ys, couldn't I make similar arguments for the higher dimensional cases? Like, even though I don't...
Yes, you can. Just at this level of the argument, you wouldn't notice that there is something special about 4D. So this argument works for any D.
Okay.
So that kind of shows that, this part here... I think I was... Yeah, when we were talking about this flow to the CFT, there will be subtleties in that discussion. So in 4D, we don't expect any, but in higher D, we do expect them, and they should appear at that level. If you were doing the same thing in higher D, there would be some issues in this at this step.
Right, but if I'm far out on the branch, though, doesn't it just flow to empty space with a circle direction?
Yeah. If you're far out, that's how it flows. So there is no problem. Yeah. So the only problem arises when you go.
I don't know the details of what happens near the transition. Yeah. Okay.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. All that we are really arguing is that in some cases, there cannot be a continuous connection. That's all we established rigorously. Right? Then there are some indications only about the other cases.
But the argument here for the type 2 would also lend itself to having higher dimensions as well, right? And
this argument of the type 2 can also be made in higher dimensions, but the point of making this argument was just to notice how it was different from the one in the heterotic, just to see whether a new branch was opening up, and that might lead you to make a conjecture of what happens to the CFT at that cross point. But that's not what was happening. What was happening was the appearance of this extra massive vacua. And we haven't understood how the CFT degenerates when you take, when this extra massive vacua appear.
So do you know which fields get a BEF in this vacua?
The field P gets a BEF, and the field X and Y have BEF equal to zero.
No, but you said you have two vacua. How many isolated vacua do you have?
Oh yeah, you basically the sign of P can be either plus or minus, and that so you have these two vacua, and the theory. The theory has a chiral C2 symmetry that reflects the sign of P.
Mm-hmm.
Sends P to minus P. And that chiral C2 symmetry is necessary for implementing the right GSO projection in the type 2 theory. But here we're not doing the GSO projection. We're just considering a theory that has this C2 global symmetry. Now this business of index is related to something a little more physical, which is the appearance of deep brains. So there are some deep brains that exist on the HB side, but not on the black hole side and vice versa. So the fact that the index changes is related to the fact that the deep brains exist only on one side and not the other. So for example, You can have a D0 brain localized at the origin on the HP side, and that D0 brain would wrap the time circle, right? While on the black hole side, the time circle shrinks, so there is no non-zero. I mean, this D0 brain will just shrink to zero, okay? Now, in both cases, these brains generate some fluxes at infinity. So here at infinity, you can measure the total charge of this D0 brain configuration. But what happens is that on the black hole side, this flux is carried as electric, by an electrically charged black hole without an explicit brain source. Okay, and this is possible because precisely there is a normalizable two-form, Ramon-Ramon two-form on the black hole background, okay, and that you didn't have in the previous case. Now here, I have some speculation on the possible transition. So it might be a first order transition, but I think I find it more natural that perhaps the transition is higher order. And in other cases, what happens is that the dilaton perhaps becomes large in some region of the target space, and that should force you to include higher loops. I mean, this is one thing that could go wrong. Now, if we embed this whole story into the gauge gravity duality, we might expect that it is related to some phase transition for the holonomy of the gauge field or the Polyakov loop. Now, in both sides, the binding is broken, so this Polyakov loop has an expectation value. But maybe one conjecture is that perhaps at this special point, maybe a gap develops in the eigenvalue distribution. So if this horizontal line is theta, the eigenvalue of the holonomy, and we are in large N theory, so we have some distribution of eigenvalues. So it could be, and it's been somehow conjectured in these papers, that maybe what happens is that the gap opens up, and there is some higher order transition, a third order transition at this point. Now this looks appealing, but at least I'm personally confused about the BEVs of Wilson loops, because or the BEVs of the holonomy when you have higher wrapping numbers, where they would seem to behave. So if in this side they should behave like exponentially with n, so they should go like e to the minus n for large n, while here you expect them to decay like perhaps some power of n. And on the string side, this does not be does not seem to be the case. They both seem to be going like e to the minus n. Okay, so now I'm going to mention some curiosity, and I'm going to end with some discussion about some charged black holes. So the first, this is a curiosity, which is that the on-shell action for any classical string theory solution is purely given by a boundary term. In other words, if we consider the, for example, the gravitational action, the action is just given by a boundary term, which involves the extrinsic curvature and also derivative of the dilaton. Okay, and this is true even if you include the stringy corrections, and it's natural to think that it might be true even exactly in alpha prime. That's a property of this action, and at the level of including higher corrections, it follows very simply from the fact that the action has an overall e to the minus 2 phi multiply net. And so it's from there, you can simply see that the action should just be purely boundary term. And because the boundary term is evaluated far away, all the higher order corrections are not important, and you only need to evaluate the boundary term of the usual gravity action. Of course, when you look at these functions, they will behave in some particular way at infinity. So for example, we'll have the mass will be one parameter, and there will be a constant that tells us how the dilaton decays. And those two constants will depend on all the alpha prime corrections, because they are, in order to find them, you need to solve the equations everywhere or find the full CFT. But if you just have these two functions, then you can evaluate this action, and it's given in terms of these two functions. So these two functions will be functions of beta, for example, and they will depend on the solutions.
Sorry,
Is this
also true when you have Ramon fields? I mean, this argument of the
yes, it's also true when you have Ramon fields. Yes, thanks for asking.
That's for a different reason then.
Yes. With the Ramon fields, you don't have the e to the minus 2 phi, but you can redefine the Ramon fields, change their gauge transformation properties so that there is an e to the minus 2 phi. And then, in the usual normalization, this is not obvious, but you can change the normalization of the Ramon field so that this is clear. Okay. Some other things become more complicated, but in a way that is not relevant for this argument. So
you change like the Bianchi identities will change a little bit or something.
Yeah. Those change in ways that involve only gradients of dilaton. So so then the overall dilaton. Yeah. So this argument is still valid. Now, if you think that this is totally trivial, that I'm saying something totally trivial, this is actually not true for Einstein gravity plus higher derivative correction, such as an M theory. Of course, it's true in Einstein gravity, but because Einstein gravity is a particular case of this where the dilaton is constant. But it is not true if you have Einstein gravity plus, let's say, the R to the fourth term in M theory, then these formulas are not true. Okay. So it's a formula about the classical string theory. Now, why am I saying all this? So I'm saying this just to explain. From this point of view, it's just a curiosity about some extra simplicity of the solution. And in fact, the fact that it has this form also implies that there's a differential equation as a function of beta relating mu and c. That's just a simple curiosity. We can now consider certain charged black holes. So if your internal theory has a circle, then we can have black holes with momentum and fundamental string binding charges on this extra circle. I'm talking only about now these two particular charges of momentum and fundamental string binding. And these solutions can be obtained from a solution generating transformation that is a symmetry of the CFT. And they were obtained in the past when you consider this in the gravity approximation. But now what happens is that these transformations can also be done at the level of the full CFT. So they should be valid to all orders in alpha prime and probably even exactly in alpha prime. So given the uncharged seed solution, you can obtain the charged solution. And the thermodynamics of the uncharged solution implies and completely determines the thermodynamics of the charged solution. So if you know the functions mu and c that we had in the previous transparency from the uncharged solution, you can find corresponding functions for the charged solutions. And in order to find this thermodynamics and so on, we only need to know the asymptotic form of the uncharged solution. And this lets us compute the properties of the charged black holes. Now, all these statements are to all orders in alpha prime, and the transformations actually are different in the type 2 and in the heterotic string. So this is something that wasn't appreciated before, I think. And it can be applied both to the black hole and the HP solution. So in particular, from the uncharged HP solution, we can generate a similar solution, which contains momentum and winding charges in the extra circle. And we give in our paper the precise form of the solutions. And in particular, then you can take the extremal limit where you go to extremality. So in that extremal limit, the formula for the entropy will be, for example, different depending on whether Q left or Q right is non-zero. So Q left and Q right is the left or right moving charge on the string version. Okay. So if you take a black hole, a large charged black hole, and you go to extremality, so it turns out that this transition between black holes and the highly excited string and so on all happen as you approach extremality. Okay. And in fact, we expect that as you are approaching, this is related to how we generated the solution. So we generated the solution using the solution generating technique. And then it turns out, once you look at the details of how you do that, that as you, the black hole becomes becomes closer to extremality, the seed solution becomes a smaller and smaller black hole. That means that it will have go to the HP solution. And so as you approach extremality, you go make this transition into sort of something that looks more like a string, and eventually you'll make a transition to the free string phase. Okay. So in other words, what we are talking about here is that this black hole to string transition in for a neutral black hole is related to a similar transition for this particular charged black holes. These are charged black holes, which in the gravity approximation, if you did this naively, so if you did this limit naively, just forgetting there are all these transitions, you just took the black hole, the original charged black hole, the gravity solution. If you took the naive limit in the gravity solution, you would get that the entropy is zero, okay? But once you consider these corrections, you get a non-zero entropy. And it was observed before that the entropies qualitatively agree up to a numerical factor. And if you assume you make the transition to HP, of course, they will agree exactly, even including the numerical factor. But that agreement is related to the agreement that you have when you are close to the black hole to string transition.
So these black holes are not related by u-dualities or something like that to the D1, D5, or are they?
Yes, they are related by u-duality to D1, D5. But D1, D5 without momentum, so just D1, D5.
Yes.
So for the D1, D5, for example, there you can find some other description of the ground states.
Yeah.
And the description is different than this one. So these black holes with two charges, as you go to, depending on which duality frame you're in, you can have different descriptions. And in particular here, the description we're discussing now is even valid outside extremality, I mean, near extremality. So for non-zero temperature, but of course, low temperature. For low temperatures, you have this picture of the string that you can you transition into these strings. Now you can read this as saying, well, these black holes are very special, and here you get the transition into these strings, and it looks a bit like a fastball, but that holds because it's a very special black hole. You could take this point of view. Okay. The point of this transparency is to explain why. How the transition for the neutral black hole implies a similar picture for this particular charged black holes. These, I would say, are not the most interesting charged black holes. The more interesting charged black holes are the ones that have a non-zero horizon area, classically. And they involve, so I don't know how to, those are different. Those, as you approach extremality, even with the ordinary classical gravity solution, you will find a nice smooth metric. Okay. So I think I'm ready to conclude. So,
but isn't that in 1D5 the case where using a higher derivative correction, there was a match? Or am I misremembering? So classically it's zero, but I think it includes some higher derivative correction.
Oh, yes. So there is another calculation here. I should probably have mentioned it. This is related to taking the limit all the way to extremality, right? And in this case, including a higher derivative correction and using these OSV formulas and so on, Oguri, Baffa, and Strominger formulas, then you will find that you had a match. Yes. That's something that holds for BPS black holes.
Okay. So you say that there is no kind of analog of that you could do here?
Well, in some sense, let me see. Well, one way to say it is that from this point of view that I'm talking about here, it's surprising that that calculation worked.
Mm-hmm.
Because because you would have had to go through this transition as you approach extremality. And then in the extremal limit, you really get a different picture, the free string picture, which is, of course, the thing you want to match to. So the free string picture gives you the entropy. So yeah, we do not have an explanation for why that calculation works. Maybe it works because in some other u-duality frame, it's actually done in another u-duality frame, that calculation. So it might be that in that u-duality frame is justified.
Sorry, what is this other computation you are discussing? I missed this.
This is a computation that was done by Doublecar. And it's a computation where you take these black hole solutions, but the BPS ones, and you add a higher derivative term. And then you find, let's say, a new solution with this higher derivative term. And with the higher derivative term, the near horizon geometry is of the ADS form. So you can calculate the entropy, and the entropy matches the entropy of a free strain. Of a free BPS string with momentum unwinding.
And you'd say it's surprising because to go from one to the other, you have to pass by this middle region, and you claim that there was no transition between the blue and
red. Yes, yes. It's done in a different u-duality frame. Perhaps I shouldn't have overemphasized so much that it was surprising. So, but.
What's the u-duality frame?
It's one where the black hole charges are given by deep brains.
Okay.
Here they are in terms of momentum unwinding. I don't know whether that BPS calculation can also be done in this case. It might be.
That's actually the question, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. But maybe it can also be done in this frame. That's quite possible. Yeah, maybe there is something more to understand from by thinking about that. So from the point of view of this talk, so here when we are going through this regime, so when we cross this dotted line, we cannot trust the gravity solution or any gravity solution with higher derivative corrections. Of course, that calculation that was done before was done for the BPS case. So you are exactly at the BPS point, and maybe there is some other separate argument that explains why that works. Certainly when you are near BPS, then the gravity solution ceases to be valid. At least in this case of the weakly coupled string at this point in Mulvey space. Also this point, okay, maybe I won't say that. So we discussed the possible connection between the black hole and the self-gravitating string of Horowitz and Polchinski. For the type 2 case, we showed that the two could not be continuously connected as classical solutions. And for the heterotic case, it seems that they could be continuously connected. We also discussed how to generate the charge solutions and the transition. This type of transitions is relevant as we approach extremality for those particular black holes. There are many questions about the future. So one would like to say more about the CFD at intermediate values of beta. So, and also we would like to answer the question. We motivated this whole discussion. We would like to track the picture of the microstates through this intermediate region. And also, why is the heterotic and type 2 picture different? It's a bit surprising. We didn't expect this coming into this problem. Okay, that's all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's all thank Juan. And open for questions. Okay. So I have one. Can you construct this HP solutions? Do they exist in ADS5 and S5? Does it make sense to?
I think probably, I think it would be somewhat difficult if the radius of ADS is relatively large, because it would be more like the 10-dimensional problem. But maybe by changing, you have some parameters to play with, like the radius of ADS, and it might be that for small enough radius of ADS, they might exist. I don't know.
I'm not understanding. So if ADS is very big, shouldn't anything that exists in flat space also exist in?
Yeah, but the solution that we discussed exists when there are four non-compact dimensions or three non-compact spatial dimensions. But here we're talking about many more non-compact dimensions, and so that's.
Aren't these solutions don't exist? These gravitating strings don't exist in 10D.
No.
I see. Why? Is that a simple reason?
It's because the force of gravity is somehow stronger in higher dimensions. Well, it's weaker at long distances and stronger at short distances. So when the string is very large, it has very weak effect. And if it starts making it collapse, it just continues collapsing. It wouldn't reach an equilibrium.
Okay.
It's related to the fact that planets can exist in nice orbits in 4D but not in 10D.
Okay, cool. Other questions? I have another nice simple one. I did not know this observation that the action is always a derivative. A total derivative, but it probably has implications for one loop determinants then around classical solutions. Does it or?
I don't know why did you say that?
Well, I mean, if I expand the total derivative, I don't know. I would expect that if an action is a total derivative, that it should tell me something about the one loop determinant.
You're imagining computing the one loop determinant through some on-shell formula where you're dealing with the action is a total derivative only on shell, right? So only on shell it's a total derivative. So if you're
one loop determinant, sometimes you can consider it's still a little bit on shell, right? You sum over all possible, like one half omega for all possible small deformation.
If you think about it that way, then you could you could do that sum and you will have those formulas, but notice that you need to know the solution in order to find that boundary action. Like for you need to, it's not something that it can be expressed in terms of the boundary data alone, right? For example, if you specify beta, you need to find what the mass is as a function of beta, and that involves solving the equations, and then you can find the action.
I mean, this question seems like it would be relevant for ADS CFT. Like, if you have, like, I mean, I know examples in which, I mean, like these bubbling solutions that somehow the 10 dimensional, like, I mean, you want to compute the action in 10 dimensions, the action in the bulk. Somehow it was always a total derivative, but maybe now you trivialize it. It's always a total derivative.
Yeah.
But that, well, I wonder if that perspective is useful for like bulk computations in ADS CFT. You have the 10 dimensional solution.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it might be useful. I haven't thought about it. I mean, it's of course you need to find the solution. It's just the issue of evaluating the action, not more than that. Yeah, I haven't thought too much about it in the ADS context. Maybe perhaps you can, use the. Yeah, you can run the whole renormalization process and find the final form of the action in terms of some of the asymptotic form of all the fields. Might be useful for something.
Because if you're in five domain, whatever, or like gate supergravity, this statement is not obviously, it's not a total derivative in general, the action, right? It's only when you're in.
No, it's not in general. Yeah, it's only in weakly coupled string theory.
No, I mean that in general, I mean it's weakly coupled string theory, but it's a 10 dimensional action that's.
Yes.
Not that the five dimensional gate supergravity, whatever.
The five dimensional also. Yeah, that should also be the case. Yeah.
So it's also a total derivative always.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
So Juan, let me see if I understood. So if I have a string in 4D, I starting I start changing it, then it starts gravitating and forms this HP solution and then a black hole. And if it's in higher dimension, it should go directly to a black hole. Is this
true? Yeah, so if it depends exactly what you are doing. So if you're doing you're considering this problem dynamically or sort of statically at thermal equilibrium. So I think what seems to happen in higher dimensions is that as you start approaching the higher than temperature, the black hole would develop perhaps a very large cloud of strings and maybe become very big and before it turns completely into a string. That's probably what happens.
So for 10D, would there be a nice computation if we had infinite power in n equals 4 that we could do, starting with some single trace for a string and then growing it? Is there something one could imagine?
Well, you might compute the higher order terms perhaps in the effective action for this tachyon. So you would need to compute correlation functions. So it was a recent beautiful paper by Hartmark and one more person I'm forgetting, where they calculated the higher temperature as a function of lambda, as a function of the coupling.
Yes.
So that's
I remember, yeah. It's with quantum spectral curve, right?
So, sorry about that. The laptop, I think, had some problem.
Not at all.
You were asking about some ADS5.
Yeah, I was asking if there is a computation in n equals 4.
With integrability, people, Hartmark and somebody else computed the higher than temperature as a function of lambda.
Yeah.
That's like computing the quadratic term in the action for the chi. And maybe one can compute maybe some higher order terms. But yeah, it sounds a little complicated. I'm not sure. You're imagining computing this using integrability or?
No, I was imagining, for example, doing some weak coupling version of computation where I would study just some combinatorics of some operators that would be very big and that.
Yes. Okay. So, maybe I should have said that people have considered this. There was a paper by Haroni, Mingwala, Van Ransdonk, and I think Raju, and they considered the weak coupling version of. So they considered super young mills at finite temperature at weak coupling. And they find that, again, there is a higher on transition even at zero coupling. And then they explore the various possibilities of what exactly happens at at small coupling. But I'm not sure if it was completely figured out.
Mm-hmm.
And their description involved looking at the basically, their variables were the holonomy of the Wilson loop, which is a matrix. So it's a matrix. Then you diagonalize the matrix. It has some eigenvalues. And then you integrate out the rest of the fields, all the other fields. And that gives an effective potential for the eigenvalues. And then you could have the possibility of having that the eigenvalues are exactly constant. And that would correspond to the empty ADS. Phase, and or that the eigenvalues sort of get close together, and there is some kind of attractive force between the eigenvalues. They get closer together.
So this is finite temperature zero coupling.
Yeah, finite temperature zero coupling. So
mm-hmm. I see. Nice.
Yeah, there is in that case. I think there is a first order transition between the two, and. And weak coupling, it wasn't clear what was happening.
And instead of putting temperature, could I put some extra very heavy operator? or will I just be making my
Yeah, that's that you could also do that. Ask what the representation of this operator is.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Nice.
I guess you could in principle look at But I'm not sure exactly how you check. I mean the end, yeah. Yeah, I guess as a function of the mass, you would like to see how the entropy rises for that operator, or that set of operators, I guess. I mean, if you have one definite operator, of course, the entropy would be zero.
You could also take one operator and then take a probe and see how the probe behaves in the presence of the operator, right? And see if
yes.
it reacts as in the presence of a black hole or something.
Yes. The type of calculation was discussed a lot in three dimensions. So people looked at the conformal blocks and this way.
But there it was just kinematics in a way, right? It was you could take advantage of Virasoro.
Properties of the conformal group. Yeah.
Here it will be much more dynamical, right? If you do it.
Yeah, there is dynamical gravity. But I guess the conclusion of the three-dimensional case was that whenever the identity was propagating in some channel, you would reproduce black hole formulas.
Yes.
And so here in higher dimensions, presumably there is a similar statement, but not just with identity, but identity and products of stress tensors and so on.
Yes. Yeah, it sounds very hard though because of Tetra.
Nice.
Anyone has any other question? Okay. If not, thanks a lot, Juan.
Very nice. Okay. Thank you very much. Bye bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.